just suppose for a minute that I did not like the President of the United States, that I did not think that he was doing a good job. Suppose instead I built a clay model of a president and I set it in my house and I decided that I would not ask the real president of this country for anything because I did not agree with him. Instead, I would go to the clay model of the president and anything that I asked him, I could be sure that he would respond. In fact, I would put an imaginary pen in his hand and I could imagine him signing great decrees that would allow me to do great things. The only problem, of course, would arise if I decided to act on one of those imaginary decrees. Because if I would act on one of those imaginary decrees, I would come across a very non-imaginary authority who would instruct me on what was real and what was imaginary. I suppose if I was bullheaded enough, I would continue to argue and believe no matter how much reality came up and slapped me in the face. It would be even more absurd if I had a chance to meet the real president, but would decline because I preferred the clay president over the real president. Now, we're thinking, this would be the act of abject insanity, that somebody who would do that would need to be locked up. But yet, people do the same thing, not with the president, but with God. Turn me to the book of Isaiah, chapter 40. Isaiah, chapter 40. We began Isaiah, chapter 40, last week. And this week, we are down in verse 12. We're actually overlapping a couple of verses because these verses were a transition. Last week was about God's comfort. And one question that one might ask is, if I am coming to God for comfort, it is the same question that God answered to Moses in the Torah reading this morning from Exodus chapter 6. The question is, if God is going to provide the answer, then the first question we have to ask is, God powerful enough to provide the solution? If we are coming to God for comfort, does God have the authority to work that comfort? I remember when I started to work for a small company, that my first day on the job, this gentleman approached me for help in setting up the computer network. Not knowing any better, I went along with him and was pointing out to him what he ought to do. Little did I know that in fact there was a turf battle going on between him and the office manager over who actually did have the authority to do that. And so as a result, I wound up solidly between these two very powerful individuals, and it was not a pleasant place to be. So the first question you have to ask, if somebody promised you that he will give you comfort and be able to resolve your situation, is he indeed capable? So that's what the second part of Isaiah chapter 40 is all about. The first chapter was about God's comfort and God's promises. The second chapter is like in the Torah portion when God recounted his great dealings with the ancestors of Moses. Here God is going to recount his own qualifications for the job. Isaiah chapter 40 verse 12. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand and marked off the heavens by the span and calculated the dust of the earth by the measure and weighed the mountains in a balance, and the hills in a pair of scales? Well, nowadays, scientifically, we can maybe get an estimate for the weight of mountains, and maybe an estimate for the amount of dust. But for an exact figure, you're not going to get that out of science. It's sort of like at work, oftentimes we come across a project that was done years ago. And to resume work on the project, the first question is asked is, who worked on it originally? Because when you're dealing with something, you go back to the original designer, and it is the original designer who will have the answers. The question here can only be answered by the one who created the world, because he knows how much dust he made. And so you go back to God, and God is saying, of course I have the power, because the answer to this question is understood to be only God himself knows the answer, because only God himself made this world. And if God made this world, if he made everything from the smallest speck of dust to the highest mountain, and everything in between, including us, then God has the power to do whatever he wants to with that creation that he made. And also his understanding of his creation as the maker of that creation, he understands the creation like no one else does. That's one of the ways in which science today has stepped in order to try to substitute itself or man's knowledge for God, but it winds up being more or less like the Egyptian magicians were trying to duplicate the things of God. Science today could step forward and say, well, I suppose that we could get a pretty accurate measure of the amount of dust in the world or the weight of mountains, but not an exact measure. Not an exact measure. Only God can do that. Only God has that depth of knowledge and understanding. A depth of knowledge and understanding that transcends man's knowledge and ability, and it will always transcend man's knowledge and ability, no matter how advanced we get scientifically. Our advancement just simply means that we are discovering things about the universe which God created. That we are in fact not inventing anything new, simply discovering things that God already invented. It's funny to watch how much in science that we give ourselves credit for are actually things that we have learned from watching the more complex and greater things that God has done. We look around us, even as we watch airplanes, we would not have gotten the idea for an airplane had not there been birds. And we would not have gotten the idea for the wing of an airplane had we not understood the wing of birds. And the examples just go on and on and on of the things that we have not invented, but rather discovered that mind of God has invented. Verse 13, who has directed the Spirit of the Lord, or as his counselor has informed him? I can guarantee you it's not me. And the answer to this is implied to be nobody. This is something that some of the writers of the Talmud needed to rediscover. There are some very blasphemous portions, apparently, in which it speaks about rabbis being called upon by God for their advice. That is pure absurdity, that God does not need our advice. Our only appropriate answer to God is yes, sir. That God does not expect any other answer, that God need give any other explanation, for God has great understanding. He does not need our direction. He does not need our advice. He does not need our counsel. It is a great miracle that God does listen to our prayers, that God does listen to our requests. However, he does not need our counsel. We don't have to give God advice on how he's going to do stuff. Rather, God himself can work that out just fine. Thank you very much. All of human wisdom, where it is true, it is derived from God. Where it is false and fanciful, that is our contribution. All that is true comes from God. All that is false, we manage to add our own selves. So no one directs the Spirit of God. No one gives him counsel. He is above human counsel. He is above human wisdom. He is the author of human wisdom. Verse 14, with whom did he consult, and who gave him understanding, and who taught him in the path of justice, and taught him knowledge, and informed him of the way of understanding? Nobody can stand up and say, oh yeah, I had God in my first grade class. I taught him all he knows. No, that's not how it works. God did not have to grow up and be taught by anybody. Nobody taught God anything. Nobody can teach God anything. It's sort of funny that I think I have gotten over this, but at one point in my life, it was like my day job was a very technical sort of occupation where there are some esoteric things going on, and I pray to God for solutions of things, and I found myself explaining to God what I was asking for, and I had to stop myself and say, wait a minute, this God made my brain. He created me. He created all the pieces I'm working on. He created all the order in the world that gave rise to mathematics. I don't have to explain to God these technical things like He wouldn't understand them. God understands every single thing that's going on, that we don't have to explain to Him things that are complicated in terms of technology or in terms of legal or in wisdom or anything. Rather, it is God who can explain to us rather than us explaining to Him what's going on. Verse 15. Behold, the nations are like a drop from a bucket and are regarded as a speck of dust on the scales. Behold, He lifts up the islands like fine dust. In our point of view, nations are big things. Big, big, big. There's patriotism, there's nationalism, there's the rise of different rulers. It's things that people really get all excited about. We look at the things that are going on in the Middle East right now. There is turmoil. There is political unrest. There's all sorts of things that we can get tied up in that and think that the political life is the most important part of life. It's all there is. Well, I'm not saying that believers should be totally out of politics in terms of influencing our culture. I think believers ought to have a hand in all aspects of life. The arts, the culture, the sciences and politics and all the rest, in order to influence them from God's perspective. But from God's perspective, our greatest political power is like dust. It's not even like Legos or finger paints. And if it was that, you could sort of go along with it. That at least we accomplished something. But what he's saying is that the nations in his eyes are just not important to him. That they do not really rank in his consideration. Yet sometimes you think when you're praying, you think, well, maybe God doesn't have the time to think about helping me find my car keys, that he's off helping, China deal with famine or something. But in God's minds, it's topsy-turvy to what we're thinking about. In God's minds, the individual is paramount, and nations are like dust. And the nations are only important in their effect upon individuals, so that it is not the case that the nation is more powerful, is more important than the individual, but the individual is more important than nations. Nations rise and fall. Individuals last forever. Either in heaven or in hell, individuals last forever. Men and women are going to last forever in some form or another. Nations come and go. Nations rise to power. Nations fall from power. 100 years ago, England was the power to be reckoned with. Now England is just one of many nations of equal power. Now, in our day, America is the power to be reckoned with. Will it still be a power to be reckoned with in 100 years? Probably not. I'm not being unpatriotic here. I'm just being realistic. That is the flow of history. Nations rise to prominence and power, and nations fall from prominence and power. Our nation is no different than other nations in that regard. We have our time in the sun, we have our time in the world stage, and then that time passes and we move on. In the Haftorah reading from Ezekiel 28 and 29, we heard about Egypt. Egypt at one time was a world power. Egypt was the power to be reckoned with. It rose to prominence and then it fell from prominence. And in our day, Egypt is not on the world stage a nation to be reckoned with. I mean, it's still a nation, it still has its people and its government and its problems and its blessings, but it is not a world power like it used to be. The nations are like a drop from a bucket. Verse 16, even Lebanon is not enough to burn, nor its beasts enough for a burnt offering. Lebanon in those days, we think of Lebanon, Lebanon was known for its forests and for its wild animals. It's almost like saying that all the lumber in Washington State is not enough for an offering, or all the forests of Pennsylvania or Vermont, a place that is well forested, saying not even all the trees, all the forests of this well forested place is enough to burn, to make a burnt offering sufficient for God, nor are all the beasts enough to make a burnt offering sufficient for God. Verse 17, all the nations are as nothing before Him. They are regarded by Him as less than nothing and meaningless. It's even worse than just a bunch of kids having a fort in the woods and a club. I mean, think of it from that perspective. A bunch of kids get together, they build a fort in the woods, and they have a club together. And that's about the level of nations in God's eyes, or even worse than that. He calls them meaningless. So these are the characteristics and the qualifications of the real God. This is reality. There is a God. He is real. He is a force to be reckoned with. Verse 18, to whom then will you liken God, or what likeness will you compare with Him? As for the idol, a craftsman casts it, a goldsmith plates it with gold, and a silversmith fashions chains of silver. He who is too impoverished for such an offering selects a tree that does not rot. He seeks out for himself a skillful craftsman to prepare an idol that will not totter. These idols were made by men who are fallible, men who are no wiser or more spiritually powerful than other men. And it says, I like that part about finding a piece of wood that isn't rotted. Because if you're not careful, wood rots. You're talking about the eternal God versus a piece of wood that rots. And you're talking about the God who made the world compared with an idol that you have to be careful that doesn't fall over on its own face. I mean, we talked about the clay president being absurd. This is beyond absurd. This is abject insanity that one would turn away from the living God because one does not like who He is and instead make a fake God out of wood or out of metal and bow down before that, pretending that that has some sort of spiritual power. Verse 21, do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been declared to you from the beginning? Have it you not understood from the foundations of the earth? This should not be new stuff. This should not be new news. This should be something that is well understood. In fact, the absurdities of modern man who tries to explain away creation without involving God is astounding. It is absolutely astounding that never in our experience have we seen anything arise out of chaos without something intelligent doing it, that nowadays we could say, well, it just happened. It is absolutely absurd the lengths that people will go to deny this declaration that was understood from the foundations of the earth. Verse 22, it is He who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers. Who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them out like a tent to dwell in? We have a sense nowadays of how big that curtain is. That is one honking big curtain. It goes on far beyond anything that the human mind can grasp. It goes on for more than billions of miles. I always laugh at these early science fiction movies that talked about being billions of miles away from a particular star. Well, the outermost planet is more than billions of miles away from our star. Billions of miles doesn't even get you out of the neighborhood. I mean, you're talking about trillions of miles in order to get really far enough away to be really out of the district. And the size of the of one particular galaxy is hundreds of thousands of light years, and I don't remember how many trillions of miles a light year is, but it's hundreds of thousands of trillions of miles, and then there are billions of galaxies out there. It just goes on and on and on. That it just I don't think we've seen to the end yet. I don't think we have telescopes that are powerful enough to see how far this all extends, that it just goes on and on and on and on and on. And God made that, and you say to yourself, well, God, why did God make all that? And the answer was, it was no trouble at all. That God just spread it out just as easily as one would put a curtain on a window. That God just spread it all out. It was no trouble for Him at all. And to us, everybody on the earth, in perspective, in terms of the power of God versus the power of men in their flesh, is that we are like grasshoppers. And if you've ever seen how powerful a grasshopper is, the answer is not much. The grasshopper flies at you, you just go pink, and that's the end of the grasshopper. It goes tumbling over end, and it's gone. It just lands in the bushes, and if it's lucky, it kind of picks itself up and kind of looks kind of dazed for a minute and then goes on. But grasshoppers, in general, do not have a great deal of power. I mean, at least you could have called us bees or hornets. At least then we'd be something to be scared of, but not a grasshopper. Nobody's scared of a grasshopper. Verse 23, He it is who reduces rulers to nothing, who makes the judges of the earth meaningless. God has the power to raise up and to set down. We talked about nations have their time in the sun, and then their time is over with. Well, who is responsible for raising up and setting down? It is God Himself. That He can humble the mightiest of nations, and He can raise up the humblest of nations in order to have prominence, and that is all up to God. And the rulers of those nations can be raised up or they can be set down. We just saw in Isaiah a little while ago, a few chapters back, we saw what God did to mighty Assyria and the ruler of Assyria, how he thought he was hot stuff until God got a hold of him and first stripped away his army and then took away the guy's own life. Verse 24, scarcely have they been planted, scarcely have they been sown, scarcely has their stock taken root in the earth, but He merely blows on them and they wither, and the storm carries them away like stubble. That they have no power to resist the mighty hand of God. Sometimes man stands up and shakes his fist at God, and you have to just kind of chuckle. That is like an ant shaking his fist at the foot that is about to land on him. It's just not going to accomplish very much. Maybe give his arm some exercise, but it's not going to give him any success otherwise. Verse 25, to whom then will you liken me that I would be his equal, says the Holy One. And the answer after we have seen all this is nobody. There is no one who even comes close. There is no one who is even in the same league. There is no one even in the same ballpark. There is no one who can be called even by the same name as God. Verse 26, lift up your eyes on high and see who has created these stars. The one who leads forth their host by number, he calls them all by name. Because of the greatness of His might and the strength of His power, not one of them is missing. That God not only created it, but He maintains it. And there are billions of stars just in our galaxy alone, and there are who knows how many galaxies, possibly millions of those, and we don't have words for numbers those that high. I think quadrillions, who knows. But all these stars, and God has names for them. We don't even have names for all the stars. I mean, we just have numbers for them after a while. We just gave up trying to give names of it. There are names for the older stars. The first ones, the brightest ones that people saw, generally are named like Sirius and Betelgeuse and stars like that. But for little stars or stars that are recently discovered, they just have numbers associated with them because we ran out of names. We just got tired of making up names for them. But God has names for each and every one of them. And he knows them by name, and he can identify them, and he remembers them. I know I have difficulty remembering more than 6 or 7 things at a time, but God remembers the names of billions of stars. He knows all about them, and he calls them out by name. So what's the point, you say? Get to the point. Verse 27, why do you say, O Jacob, and assert, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and the justice to me escapes the notice of my God? After all this, seeing who God is and seeing His power and seeing His holiness and seeing His glory, that one could say that, well, maybe he just missed what was going on. Maybe he just couldn't handle it. Maybe he just didn't see what was happening. And Isaiah says, that's a stupid thing to say. That God does know, verse 28, do you not know? Have you not heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, does not become weary or tired. His understanding is inscrutable. And he is also, by the way, not dead. He is very much alive. That was something that was in the 60s. I don't know if those people who lived through that, there was the God is dead motion that came out of some brain-dead theologian somewhere who said that, well, the answer to all this must be that God is dead. I don't think so. That God is not, does not get weary, He does not get tired, and He does not die. So God is still there, and if it looks like things are not going according to plan, then maybe we don't understand the plan. That there is a plan, and God is working the plan, and God is faithfully accomplishing the plan, and if what we see doesn't make any sense, then the problem is not with God, the problem is with us. Yes. That we just don't understand, but God does understand, and God knows what He's doing, and it is all working together, whether we understand it or not. Verse 29, He gives strength to the weary, and to him who lacks might, He increases power. Though youth grow weary and tired, and vigorous young men stumble badly, yet those who wait for the Lord will gain new strength. They will mount up with wings like eagles. They will run and not get tired. They will walk and not become weary. It's easy to get tired. It really is. And I'm not just talking about not getting enough sleep because the dog was barking in the middle of the night, or not getting enough sleep because you've been working hard. But I'm talking about getting weary with life itself. And getting weary to the point that you think that it's just not worth it anymore. Or maybe the stuff that you're doing just isn't mattering or isn't just working out. That maybe you ought to just give up on all this and just not bother because it's just too much. That's the weariness I'm talking about. A soul weariness that says that God doesn't see and it's just not going to work. It's just not going to happen. That's not going to be of any use. And God says that He gives strength to the weary. But the strength to the weary is to those who wait upon the Lord. A lot of times people get weary because of the fact that they have stopped operating in the sphere of God's plan and they have started operating in their own plan. And the weariness comes from the fact that they, in their own strength, cannot accomplish it. Picture a grasshopper trying to pull a car down the street. God said we're all grasshoppers. Well, you have the poor little thing with a little tiny chain in its mouth just trying as hard as it can to pull a car down the street. It is not going to happen. The grasshopper is not going to pull the car down the street. But even if there is no gas in the car, a strong man can push that car down the street. And sometimes we get weary in well-doing because we are trying to do the pulling and we just don't have the strength for it. But if we wait upon the Lord and we trust in the Lord and we work His plan in His power and His provision, then we will be able to move mountains. It says that we will mount up with wings like eagles, run and not get tired, and walk and not become weary. Some people just never have the experience of actually doing things for God. And by personal testimony, I can tell you that when you do things for God, that you have a strength that you never thought you would have. That you accomplish things that you never thought you would accomplish. That you move forward in doing things that you would have thought were impossible. It's like Moses standing before Pharaoh when he had said that he was slow of speech. That was something that Moses was terrified of. He said that he couldn't handle it. That was something that he just wasn't equipped for. Well, God helped him initially, but that was something that in the strength of God he was able to accomplish. And not only accomplish just a little bit, but something that his words before Pharaoh, his words before the people of Israel are recorded for us to read 3,500 years later. So not only was he given the words to say before Pharaoh, but he was given the words to say to write down for all of us to read so very far in the future. Mount up with wings like eagles to soar above that which tries to pull us down, that tries to steal our joy. And there's a lot of joy stealers out there. There are a lot of things out there that will try to take you down to earth, that will try to convince you that you cannot fly. And then there's all sorts of fairy tales and all sorts of things about birds who get convinced that they cannot fly. And birds that they're convinced that they cannot fly are not very much good to anything. I mean, they're good to be slaughtered for food because they won't get away, but other than that, they are not very much good, because a bird is meant to fly, and those who have the strength of God can rise up like the eagles. It said that even the strength of young men can fail, that young men can get discouraged, but yet those who are waiting upon the Lord still have the strength for that which God has set forth for them to do. I have met people who are very advanced in years and are still really pumping along for God in ways that younger men are very timid to accomplish. And I have met some men that are still going strong and are still accomplishing things, that refuse to stop flying, that continue to move forward in the strength of God. And this is the same God. You have to understand the whole chapter has fit together in that this is talking about the characteristics of God. We're not just talking about gaining some sort of imaginary strength from some sort of imaginary God that is nailed to a shelf somewhere so that a breeze wouldn't blow it over. But we're talking about the God who made everything, who is promising to us that if we wait upon Him, we will have the energy to complete the task. That we will not find ourselves falling short of resources at a critical moment because somehow God ran dry, or God got distracted or had to sneeze or something and wasn't there when we needed Him. God is there. God is able to work His plan, and God has the will to work His plan, and God will give us the strength to do what He is calling us to do. And so we have no reason to tell God no, that we don't have the strength or the energy to do something that God is calling us to do. Because we supply the willingness, God will supply the resources and the energy for us to accomplish what God has set forth for us to accomplish. Not what we want to accomplish, but what God wants us to accomplish. And that's quite a difference. And that's a difference that must be discerned by prayer and thinking on God's Word and thinking about His plan for you. But if it truly is God's will for you, God will provide the way. And that way involves changing you and growing you into the position so that even though you're looking at it and saying, I could never do that, well, right now maybe you can't, but if you start doing it, God will provide the means that you will be able to successfully complete that which He has set forth for you to do. Mount up like on wings like eagles is a very pleasant place to be. And if we allow ourselves to be dragged down by the anxieties of life all around us, we'll never know what it's like to soar. Let's pray. Dearest God and Father, I thank You that You have allowed us into Your presence, that You are unlimited in power and knowledge and wisdom, and we are limited in virtually everything. I thank You that You are strong and have offered to us your strength instead of our weakness, and you have promised to us that as we wait upon you, that you will provide the strength for the journey, that you will provide the resources for the work, that you will empower us to do what needs to be done. Father, grant us all wisdom that we might see what needs to be done and what part you are calling us to play, that we might be faithful and that we might experience that great joy of soaring in your kingdom as we wait in joyful hope for the coming of our Messiah Yeshua. Amen.